Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski. If you're tuning in to this podcast, you're going to hear a conversation by current and former journalists talking about some of the biggest stories that have occurred within the last week. The purpose of the podcast is to cut through the hyperbole and give you, the audience, an idea of what might really be going on. What stories are we going to discuss this week? We're going to be talking about 8,400 condos and apartments going up in downtown Miami on a 27-acre site called Miami World Center. We're also going to talk about tech workers. There's tons of jobs, but are there enough employees that are skilled enough to do the work? Talking about Fett Village. Don't know where Fett Village is? Well, it's a community in downtown Fort Lauderdale. Could it be the next Wynwood? And also Hialeah. Hialeah is an area in the suburbs of Miami. It's known for being more reasonably priced housing. Now there's a rash of evictions going on. Another story we're talking about, there's a company that opened up in Pompano Beach. They are creating prefab homes. And the idea is that they can actually resist as much as a Category 5 hurricane. And then finally, we're going to wrap it up with smokers. Everybody who's lived into a condo or an apartment building, you've had a problem with smoke, whether it's cigarette smoke or it's the illegal weed type of smoke. We're going to talk about what can you actually do if you live in one of these buildings. After the break, we'll get into our podcast.
Welcome to the CondoVultures.com podcast with your host, Peter Zalewski, a Miami real estate broker, Wall Street consultant, and expert witness. This podcast is focused on identifying real estate buying opportunities in the South Florida condo market of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. The CondoVultures.com podcast is not authorized by the South Florida real estate industry and will most likely annoy many of the region's talking heads. This podcast will feature straight talk and salty language that could be offensive to some. Please remember that past investment success does not determine future gains, especially in South Florida's volatile condo market. For more information, please visit condovultures.com. Don't buy a South Florida condo, discounted or distressed, before taking a Condo Vultures correction tour. Condovultures.com offers weekly bus and walking tours that focus on educating buyers on the how-tos of identifying discounted condos, analyzing the opportunities, and purchasing units. Every tour attendee receives a list of all condo projects in a particular market, a market assessment handout, and unmatched expert analysis. For more information on the condo correction tours, please visit condovultures.eventbrite.com.
This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures podcast. I hope you're enjoying the podcast, and I wanted to alert you that if you have a property that you're looking to sell in the Tri-County South Florida area, I would encourage you to reach out to Jenny Cortez, a licensed real estate broker with CVRRealty.com. She's my partner. She's been in the business for north of 15 years. More importantly, she knows the market. She knows how to get that deal done. And she also realizes that it's more important to get a price that you can accept and sell the property rather than to hold firm on some price that's never going to be achieved and ultimately languish on the market. So if you're looking to do a deal that you want a skilled expert who can help you sell a property, reach out to Jenny Cortez at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859, or visit her website, CVRRealty.com.
Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski of Condo Vultures. If you're tuning into this podcast, you can hear a conversation by current and former journalists talking about some of the biggest stories that have occurred within the last week or so. The objective of the podcast, cut through some of the fluff, some of the hyperbole, and give you an unauthorized perspective and a skeptical perspective about what might really be going on in the market. I have three other journalists on the podcast with me. I handpicked six stories, sent them off to the journalists, asked them to give them a read, and I'm going to ask them to comment. Let me go ahead and introduce our journalists. We have a gentleman who was a journalist for over 25 years. Right now, he has his own public relations marketing firm called Gruce Communications. No one else but John Gruce. If you want to check out John's website for his company, go to grusspr.com, G-R-U-S-S-P-R.com. If you want to get him on X, which is formerly Twitter, get him at Jean Gruss, J-E-A-N-G-R-U-S-S. Mr. Gruss, how's it going?
Hey, Peter, ready to get cut through the fluff.
Cut through the fluff on an unauthorized podcast. And I failed to mention it. This is actually episode 7 of season 5. We have another one of our regulars. This gentleman was a journalist for over 20 years, including working in a publication called the South Florida Business Journal. Wrote about white collar crime and as well as other stories. Right now he does public relations and marketing. No one else but John Fackler. You want to get a hold of John on X, which is formerly Twitter, get him at JT Fackler, J-T-F-A-K-L-E-R.
Mr. Fackler, what's going on? I know this is a busy week for you. It is the we're coming up on the end of April, which means NFL draft time. Everybody who follows the podcast knows you are a big NFL fan. Fortunately, you go for the New York Jets and you live in Miami Dolphin territory.
Well, I'm glad to be back, and I'm also looking forward to Thursday, which is the opening night of the draft. First round is Thursday. It'll be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, so I'll be, locked down, so to say.
And who else do we have on the podcast this week? Our visiting journalist this week is David Lyons. David's a senior staff writer over at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And in the conversation before the podcast, David revealed to us he's going to be celebrating 50 years as a journalist. David, wow, we're blown away. How's it going? And B, how's it feel to be putting up with sources for 50 years?
Well, I stopped drinking a long time ago, but so anyway, no, things are good up here in Greater Fort Lauderdale, where the snowbirds are finally heading home for the summer season, and so the restaurants are fewer waiting lines and the traffic is a little less. So even though and a lot of people are putting their places up for sale because it's getting a little too expensive here.
David, quick question. You're originally from upstate New York. I don't know if you're an NFL fan, but I just wonder, are you an NFL fan? And if you are, which team do you follow?
Sure. Well, I've been following the New York Giants ever since Y.A. Tittle and Charlie Connolly and Sam Huff and all the rest. So I watched the Giants lose the Green Bay Packers in the early 60s. They could never get over the hump. And, of course, that was also the period in which Jim Brown was storming up and down the field for the Cleveland Browns after graduating from Syracuse University. So that was...
And Mr. Lyons, as a true New Yorker, any opinion about the New York Jets, the hated New York Jets, Miami Dolphins territory?
Nah, they're kind of in a distant second place for me. I do remember seeing the Jets play New England at the old Shea Stadium a long time ago. But that's the only Jets game I ever saw. So,
obviously, not worth going back for a second look. Very interesting, Dan. Let's go ahead and talk about our rules of engagement. So the podcast, it comes out every week. We're going to be doing 20 shows, season 5. And if you have any comments for us, you like what we're saying, you dislike what we're saying, please go ahead and shoot us a message at X, which is follow Twitter. You can get us at @MiamiRRP, @MiamiRRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. Not AARP, but MiamiRRP. And then also to sponsorship for the podcast. It's actually my firm, CondoVultures.com, CondoVultures.com. We do a variety of different things, whether it's statistics, whether it's consulting, expert witness, and even buy-side brokerage. So if you are interested, go and check out the website. Maybe sign up for the newsletter, CondoVultures.com. So all that being said, let's go ahead and get into our podcast. So, John Bruce, we're going to start off with you with story number one. This is coming out of The Real Deal. I'm going to read you the headline first, couple graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline, Miami's World Center pipeline of 8,400 resi units, 500 hotel keys. I should tell everybody, the Miami World Center, for what it's worth, it was originally planned in the early 2000s during the, I guess, the last great condo boom. It's supposed to go on in an area where there used to be the old Miami Arena. There was also a homeless shelter called the Camille's House, as well as some other stuff. All of that has since moved. The old arena was torn down. And right now, there's a whole variety of condo projects and rental projects, as well as high-end retail that's getting built there. So that's a background Miami World Center. Where is it geographically? It is effectively about a block west of where the Miami Heat basketball team plays in the Kaseya Center, formerly known as the American Airlines Arena. So here we go with the first couple graphs, John. Developers are racing to Miami World Center. The 27-acre master plan development is partially completed, but much of it is untapped. 17 towers are proposed, approved, or under construction, promising to transform a 10-block stretch in the heart of Miami into a canyon of skyscrapers. In total, the project would add nearly 8,500 condos and apartments, nearly 500 hotel keys, and nearly 800,000 square feet of commercial space, according to an analysis by The Real Deal. Miami World Center Associates, led by Art Falcone and Nit Motwani, in partnership with Los Angeles-based CIM Group, are the master developers of the $6 billion complex at the intersection of downtown Miami and the city's Park West neighborhood. Over the years, they've sold off buildable lots to developers while also building on their own or partnering with others on the project.
John, 8,500 resi units. They're talking about in a 10-block stretch, 27 acres. Miami's supposed to be the gateway to Latin America. We're supposed to be getting 1,000 people a day coming to Florida. But do we need that much damn space?
Yeah, it just seems like oversupply. You know, maybe the result of years of cheap financing, more than demand. This overwhelming supply is just almost inconceivable to me. I recently had a friend who was staying in that development in a hotel, and I have to say, from a planning perspective, it was really, really difficult to get to. It was really difficult to get around. I just can't imagine all these additional condo and apartment and hotel units. It's just pretty massive. And, you know, it just, I worry that that when the music stops, and it will stop at some point, a lot of these projects will be sort of halfway built or just newly built, and will sit empty for a while, and it's going to be, it's going to mean trouble. I think bringing all of that supply all at once is highly speculative. We've seen it before. Florida is boom and bust. That's the story of Florida. And this is another exhibit in the history of Florida.
Jean, let me ask you a follow up question before I put it to the floor. There's a saying in Wall Street: buy on the rumor, sell on the news, if you will. This project was proposed back there in the 2003, 2004, 2005 boom. Never actually got off the ground. The developer had to unload some dirt, basically to try to stay afloat, if you will. Memory serves me correct. Here we are coming forward now. I just wonder, everybody thinks in real estate, you go ahead, you want to hurry up and invest now because it's only going to go up. But we're talking 20 years or so. Do you have any suggestions for maybe anybody who's out there who might be watching this podcast or listening to the podcast in terms of what kind of urgency is there? Does it make sense to go in early, generally speaking, based on your experience, 25 years of reporting, writing about real estate, finance, and other things? Or does it make more sense to some sort of, temper your enthusiasm and wait till it actually comes online to see what the hell you're getting?
Yeah, it depends where in the cycle you think we are. Are we close to the peak, or are we closer to the beginning? And we may have already passed the peak of the most recent boom. And so perhaps it might be wise to sort of take a step back and look and see what's going to happen. I don't know where we are in the cycle. I don't think anybody really does, but I would bet that we're closer to the end of this boom than we are at the beginning.
And to that point, Sean, there was a story that came out subsequently, and it's not in here, but one of the developers is actually building a condo tower on spec. Spec meaning he does not have the sales, but he's that confident in the development. He's going to go ahead and self-fund it or fund it somehow without the pre-sales. Any reaction to that?
Yeah, speculative construction is a hallmark of the boom. We've had speculative developments in Florida during every boom. And, this time is no different. And, it's a gamble. It's a gamble that you're going to fill the space, you're going to fill the units. And, my hat's off to developers. They got balls, they got the balls they got the balls to do it. I think it's highly risky, but if they pull it off, they're going to make bang,
David Lyons, let me ask you a question. You're going on 50 years being a journalist of the Lyons Share down here in South Florida, a long time at the Miami Herald, where their headquarters used to be just up the street from this Miami World Center that we're talking about. So you obviously know the area pretty well. You saw it from what it used to be to kind of what it is. Can you just provide some color for the audience, maybe people who aren't as familiar with Miami and some of its history, what was going on in this area, let's say from Bayside North to where the Herald headquarters used to be, and then the Bay West to like Interstate 95.
Any kind of color description you can share with the audience?
Well, the one word I can use for the 1980s was raw. I mean, we all know what was driving the economy back then, and a certain product from the Southern Hemisphere came up here by water and boat. And I can remember standing, a couple of months, and the Liberty City riots broke out. And I remember standing on the roof of One Herald Plaza, glancing over toward Overtown and seeing a car on fire upside down in the middle of an intersection, and there were no firemen around because they didn't dare. And then, of course, as the years unfolded, that infamous Time magazine cover, that essentially described a city under siege. But the driving forces, it was kind of an outlaw type of an economy that was driving the construction and the building, and that spot that we're talking about now, the World Center, is nothing but a bunch of low-lying warehouses and pawn shops and some late-night discos and whatnot, and it was not a place that you really want to be walking through at night. And so it was definitely, as I said, it was a very raw type feel about the city, and there was a certain amount of glamour, as a result of the Miami Vice police TV show with Don Johnson and all the rest. But that's when I think the architecture and the allure of Miami really started to come forward.
And I will say before we go to the next story, this area, Miami World Center, this is the first time I ever saw air conditioning compressors on top of the roof of a one-story warehouse, and they had cages around them so they wouldn't get stolen. Just to give you some context, back in the 1990s. Right. We're going to go to David Lyons with story number two. David, this is a piece you actually wrote. It appeared in the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I'll read you the headline for a couple graphs. Then I want you to provide some insight. You wrote the story, so you might not be able to comment, but maybe you can share with the audience just some insight related to it. Now, just to give the audience some background, during the pandemic, state of Florida was open. This was a place that basically said you didn't need a mask. You want to come down here and twerk on a police car, come on down. And we saw a lot of tech workers who working for companies out of Silicon Valley or New York or elsewhere. They all decided to come down to Florida. They could live a somewhat open type of lifestyle. They had the weather, they had everything else. And they were getting paid for companies that were based in California, New York, or elsewhere. So that's the background. So here we go with the headline, first couple graphs, David. Then I want you to provide some insight. South Florida sees gains in relocating tech workers to the region, but are they enough to fill the demand? First couple graphs, South Florida's got tech talent, but are there enough professionals to go around for the startups, existing companies, and public agencies to keep their customers happy? Last week, San Francisco-based SignalFire released a survey of 18 U.S. metropolitan areas that showed New York leading the nation in attracting relocating technology workers in 2023. The Big Apple's net gain, 3.5%. San Francisco was last with 3.7% net decline. The Miami-Fort Lauderdale area came in fifth with a fractional net gain in a survey that tracked the movement of workers among 10 of the country's largest technology firms by market capitalization. Amazon, Alphabet, and Meta were among them, along with various large privately held companies. David, what did you find in reporting out the story?
Well, it's a reaffirmation of what I've been hearing before. A lot of technology entities have been coming into South Florida. The mayor, Suarez, during the troubles of Northern California, quite literally helped spur not an exodus per se, but certainly a certain amount of migration by technology workers to South Florida from the Northeast, California, Texas, etc., particularly in California because of the business conditions out there. And we're here to help, he said on Twitter. That wasn't the magic light switch, but it certainly signaled support, governmental support, community support for an industry that in some respects was looking to grow elsewhere or find another home elsewhere. And so in turn, a number of firms have been relocating here. And of course, over the last more than decade or so, the startup culture has blossomed as a result of contributions by everybody from the Knight Foundation to the Emerge Americas group that fosters a lot of that just talks up the industry and provides encouragement to the point where, you know, there I remember, you know, way back in 2012 being in a seminar room at the Bankers Club in downtown Miami, and there were a lot of, most of the people in the audience were entrepreneurs who were looking for mentors, money, guidance, and all the rest, you know, to help them fuel the business. The panelists on the dais were quite capable, but outside in the street there weren't all that many people who were in a position to lend help. So from there, from that ground zero type of a position, you know, the area you know, gradually emerged into what it is today. So there are a lot of businesses, but you know, the thing I keep on hearing is, yeah, there's tech talent, but is it qualified talent? Are there enough people here for the, you know, for the jobs that are available? I was looking at Indeed during the course of reporting the story, and they're statewide, there are about 10,700 job openings on Indeed.
Wow.
And there are varying stripes. I mean, there are true entry-level jobs, but there are also a lot of mid-level and higher-level jobs. You know, people looking for the talent necessary to help drive a complex organization and manage projects and do a lot of sophisticated work, you know, well beyond the coding level of a technology, you know, for technology workers who are, you know, just coming on stream. So, you know, we have this you know, picture of you have the Florida Tech or the Florida Atlantic University Tech Runway up here in Boca Raton, and the Nova Southeastern and Levan Innovation Center down in Davie at Nova Southeastern University, all places, you know, outside of Miami that are, you know, willing and able to, you know, help startup companies. But, you know, in terms of, you know, firms that are here, yeah, I think there's a need.
David, if I could interrupt you, anybody who's got any clicks on the odometer, such as myself, I've been down here 30 years. I remember back in 2000 or so, you had this whole Silicon Beach movement where the local counties were going to try to go ahead and create the situation. It was to compete with Silicon Valley. You had VC firms as well as tech companies out of Latin America setting up shop on Lincoln Road, doing it at Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach. You had an office tower built on Washington in South Beach, of all places. You had Scripps, the biomedical company that was lured by then Governor Jeb Bush. So I guess my question, I don't know if you were able to report this out, and I don't know if you can comment on it, but what the hell happened? I thought we were supposed to start this 20 years ago with Silicon Beach and Scripps, and why the hell still do we not have enough employees, or do we simply not have the quantity? Where maybe everything is operating correctly, it's just, you know, we just don't have enough people for it.
Well, I go back even farther than that. When in the 1980s, you know, when I first, in the earlier years that I was up this way, there were technology firms along Cypress Creek Road, adjacent to the Executive River. They have Bendix, their air transport and civil aviation avionics manufacturing facilities adjacent to the Executive Airport. You had Harris Corporation.
Wait, wasn't Citrix up there?
Yeah, they're still here. Okay. They're probably the the last soldier of the technology originals from the 80s in the Fort Lauderdale area. Harris was here. Motorola is still out in Plantation, of course.
IBM?
IBM was up in Boca Raton. That's where the PC evolved. From the standpoint of, you know, changes in business decisions, mergers and acquisitions, takeouts, and then, you know, the main problem here was at the time the educational institutions didn't have the horsepower to, you know, help train a lot of these individuals. So with the it was a combination of lack of talent and lack of managerial skills that a lot of investors identified that caused them to go elsewhere. So, yeah, I remember that campaign you mentioned, but it never went past an ad campaign. because I think people realized what the realities were from an educational standpoint, from the presence of, you know, qualified people, and which remains a challenge to this very day. And I, you know, probably the most salient segment of that story, you know, came from Kelly Smallridge of the, she's the CEO and president of the Palm Beach County Business Development Board. She acknowledged that you know, there's work to be done to try to you know, build the talent pool so that there's enough of a workforce to satisfy the demands of the people who have just recently arrived, or the companies that want to come here in the future.
Work to be done. Well, we'll see 20 years from now we do this podcast. We'll see if they're still claiming the same thing. That's a perfect segue to story number three. Mr. Factor, John Factor, we go to you with story number three. This piece coming out of the Miami Herald. It has to do with a community that's located in downtown Fort Lauderdale, just north of Broward Boulevard and Federal, an area called Flagler Village. It was some vacant land. It was warehouses. It's right next to the Brightline train station. So, Mr. Factor, I'm going to read the headline first, couple of graphs, and I want you to comment. And here's the headline from Miami Herald. This neighborhood is getting a makeover. Will it become the Wynwood of Fort Lauderdale? And here we go, Mr. Factor. Smack in the center of Fort Lauderdale's Flagler Village neighborhood sits a swath of land awaiting residential towers, eateries, shops, and adorn a revamped Fat Village district. Developers hope the mixed-use development will become the Wynwood of Fort Lauderdale. The idea, developer Alan Hooper said, is to capture the artistic essence of what was once there when the neighborhood had warehouses and monthly art walks, but with the addition of housing and shops. He envisioned skyscrapers with modern apartments and retail space, but with an artistic vibe similar to the one cultivated in the area before Fat Village's artsy warehouses were torn down. And here's a quote from Mr. Hooper. He says, it's a lot like Wynwood, which is going through a lot of change right now, except for when they were having art walks. The area was a little bit dilapidated. There weren't any food or beverage places other than a coffee shop and a sandwich shop. And for the size of the two blocks, it didn't offer a lot to the person that would just walk up and want to experience the neighborhood unless they were having an art walk, which was once a month. Mr. Fackler, what do you make of Fat Village and this concept of being Wynwood North, if you will? What say you, Mr. Fackler, somebody lived in Broward County for a long time and relocated to Miami, what, 5 years ago or so?
I've been in Miami about 10 years, thank you. But I did live in Broward around this time when they originally had the warehouse district, and there was, matter of fact, back in those days, I actually painted. So I actually I joined a painting sort of exhibit, a contest. So I went down there, brought my work down there, and you know, the guy comes out, the guy who was judging everything, and he pointed to my art, and he said, that's derivative. And they walked out. Well, that's the worst thing you can say to an artist. That means I'm copying an artist or you know, some sort of art form. So he walked away. Obviously, I didn't win, but he embarrassed me in front of all these artists. And I never painted again after that. It just brings back, you know, a little, you know, memory of that area. It was like the hip place to go, you know. Now, the lead is buried in this story. Apparently, the one-bedroom prices for a one-bedroom in the towers are going to start at $2,900. Second, two bedrooms are $35. The cheapest is $25. And so they were interviewing somebody at the end of the story saying, how are the nurses and the teachers and the starving artists going to be able to, you know, live there? How are they going to draw them back? And then I started thinking, you know, it's kind of exactly what happened in Wynwood. Wynwood, everybody got pushed out because of the prices. People couldn't live there. It really became a tourist destination. So I'm thinking that the Fort Lauderdale will be a replica of what happened in Wynwood, where it would be a tourist destination, but only for Broward. So to me, that's the only way it's going to work, because those prices are, you know, outrageous. I mean, as far as rentals go.
And so, Mr. Factor, are you saying that basically if you're an artist type living in this area, you have to have a trust fund?
Definitely have a trust fund or a patron. Sometimes they have a patron. Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I think the intent is good. You know, but seriously, this guy, this developer, he's been actually redeveloping that area since 2000, which is when all the warehouses started, you know, it got too expensive and everybody started to leave. So I'm not sure exactly what he's been redeveloping for almost 25 years. Only now is it suddenly, you know, he's got this idea that it's going to become the next Wynwood. So I don't know. I'm a little skeptical. I would love to see it, you know, come to fruition, but just a little bit skeptical on how this is going to play out.
Mr. Gruce, Mr. Lyons, anybody have any comment about Fat Village?
It's an area where one skyscraper after another is scheduled to go up in Flagler Village, the surrounding Flagler Village.
Yes.
And Fat Village is kind of a subset. And I don't know, my idea of an artistic vibe is not skyscrapers or high-rises, it's warehouses. So, maybe they could have done a more accessible or a job that would have fostered more accessibility if they had gone smaller and had less loftier ambitions. But you've got this mix of high-end residential, probably be high-end office, maybe some shared workspaces. But in terms of having that mentality, that artistic mentality and vibe, I don't see it. I really don't. The atmosphere is gone, and it would have taken a little bit more creativity to try to replicate what they're talking about now in Miami. So, and on the other side, and keep in mind too, the Brightline Florida East Coast Railway corridor runs right past there, and there's a crossing along the northern boundary of an African American neighborhood that's also on the rise. They've been redeveloping a lot of buildings. I think conditions have gotten a lot better. But the question is, from an ethnic standpoint, will Fat Village, what's it have to offer for the minorities who are on the other side of the railroad tracks? That's an open question that I don't think anybody's really given a hard answer to. Is there going to be a way for the people on the west side of the tracks to participate in a project that's on the east side of the tracks?
Anyone was wondering, why is it called Fat Village? It's an acronym. It stands for Flagler Arts and Technology, trying to bring it all together. Right. So that's Fat Village. We'll have to see how it plays out. Story number four, we're going to go to Jean Gruce. Jean, we're going to go to you with this piece. It comes out of the Miami Herald. Miami gets a lot of the attention. Fort Lauderdale gets the attention. This is the place people want to go. But working class types who don't necessarily want to or can't spend that kind of money, they tend to go to the suburbs. And the suburbs down in South Florida means going west. So one of the areas that for the longest time has been more reasonably priced is a place called Hialeah. Hialeah is where you got the racetrack, the Metro Rail train goes there, the Tri-Rail, which is a train that will take you throughout all three counties, Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach County, and South Florida. So that's kind of the background, John. I'm going to read you the headline first, couple graphs, and I want you to comment. Headline. Struggling to stay in Hialeah, eviction surge in new luxury enclaves. There we go with the first couple graphs. Jessica Mora moved to Hialeah 2 years ago with her husband and her daughter to a two-bedroom apartment in Puerto Vida, one of the city's newest developments on Okeechobee Road. The monthly rent for Mora's unit initially stood at $2,150. However, upon lease renewal, a major $700 increase catapulted the rent to $2,850, a sharp blow to her already strained finances. As the year drew to a close in 2023, Moore faced the added turmoil of separation from her husband, further destabilization her financial footing. Left grappling with the aftermath, she found herself in urgent negotiations with the building management to pay the rent. Yet, just 2 months later, in January 2024, the building's legal team initiated eviction proceedings, a daunting escalation of moral struggle to maintain a roof over her head. An El Nuevo Herald analysis of public records from Miami-Dade Court show that Hialeah's three largest and most modern buildings, Puerto Vida, Shoma Village, and Manor Hialeah, together have filed a total of 165 complaints for residential evictions within the last 20 months. And here is a quote from Ms. Mora. South Florida is unlivable. We are just surviving in Hialeah, said the 36-year-old Venezuelan. Jean, what do you make of that? I thought, if you're close to the water, which means east, you pay more, but you get the quality of life. But as you go west, stuff's supposed to be more affordable, more reasonable. What do you make of this, and any suggestion to maybe anybody who's out there caught in the same or similar type of situation?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the issue with South Florida is that basically a rising tide lifts all boats. In other words, rents are going up countywide. This is not just limited to the beach or to Brickell or those other areas. It's really countywide. And as developers are looking for opportunities to build new buildings and move into neighborhoods that traditionally have been not served by luxury developers. I mean, this looks like a luxury development. It's got building with a pool and a gym, and I mean, it's got palm trees. It looks like a pretty fancy place. And it seems to me that, you know, you can find fault on all sides here. The developers are, you know, going into an area that traditionally doesn't have the resources to pay those kinds of rents. But then at the same time, you have, you know, people who've been lured by reasonable rents. And once they're in there, it's kind of like they get jammed with a huge increase in rent. In this boom and bust era of Florida, right now we're in a boom, and landlords have the upper hand. How long that's going to last, I don't know. But I think you're seeing areas that are previously been, you know, reasonably priced, and now you're seeing them, you know, the rents going up again. And so, I sort of have a mixed feelings about it, because you can't, you know, you can't expect to live in South Florida and have this sort of lifestyle, a luxury lifestyle, if you're on a minimum wage. For developers, I think they have to tread a little more carefully and not you know, try to jam people into luxury developments who really, really can't afford it, and go into areas that are traditionally don't have the wealth that other areas do. And so, I mean, I think there's some mistakes in planning. There's mistakes in taking advantage of people who perhaps don't know better. I mean, we've seen the rents, for example, in areas of Brickell go up by at least those kinds of numbers. I mean, this is sort of a routine, but not in places like Hialeah.
Now, I have two New Yorkers on the podcast. I have David Lyons from upstate New York, and I have John Fackler, who's from Long Island, New York. And this is my opportunity to ask the two. And for the record, I am a capitalist. I love free markets. Gentlemen, you are former New Yorkers. Do we need rent control in South Florida, if not coastal, maybe suburban, say west of Interstate 95, where real people live?
Yeah, well, whatever happened to the workforce trend? Weren't there supposed to be all these great developments? I mean, if the kibosh has been put on that, definitely rent stabilization. I mean, I actually lived in a rent stabilized apartment in Manhattan.
Well, so, Mr. Fackler, somebody who's not from New York, what does rent stabilization mean?
It means that the rent is kept at a certain level. It can only go up a certain percentage point, a very low percentage point. I don't recall what mine was, but it really it makes landlords not be able to raise rents at a high level.
So Mr. Fackler, would that be comparable to maybe somebody who owns a house and they declare a homestead in Florida, and as a result, their property tax exposure can only go up nominally? Are you saying there's something like that similar in New York, where the rent can only go up marginally, like based on inflation or based on some sort of set schedule?
Listen, that would be a great idea, but there'll be so much politicking to keep that from coming to fruition. I doubt we'll ever see something like that. I think it's been talked about before in the past, but I don't know if there's anything on the table right now. So, and right now, it's all about greed.
Mr. Lyons, would you care to comment?
It's all about profits. And the margins must be wide. There are any number of projects where developers are supposed to do set-asides in their building, in their luxury buildings. They're supposed to be quote-unquote workforce housing, but I wonder what that is. I never hear any price points. And, you know, rent control, that's anathema for developers and whatnot. I mean, there's the Live Local Act, and Broward County just started a 10-year affordable housing program of varying stripes, that all sorts of different types of subset programs that have subsidies. And as I sit here, I'm not sure that I could recite them all, but at any rate, there's I mean, the local governments are in the process of trying to mitigate the situation, but I think it's too late. I think it's really too late, unless As was mentioned earlier, the boom bust or the bust aspect kicks in to the boom bust.
And all of a sudden, you have instant affordable housing.
Instant affordable housing, that's right. You know, I mean, there are a lot of policemen, firemen, nurses who've repaired to Collier County, the development Ava Maria over there. They've, you know, mid-age couples, young couples have gone across the state, and they commute all the way across Alligator Alley to go to work. You know, it's, that's how bad it's been. And we've had several stories on that. You know, rent control, might work, but who's going to take the first initiative to make that happen? And in a state like this, I don't see it happening.
It's a fascinating conversation, gentlemen. Let's go on with story number five. David Lyons, we're gonna go to you with story number five. This is a piece that appeared in the South Florida Sun Sentinel. You wrote it. I'm gonna read you the headline first, a couple graphs, and I want you to provide some insight. You might not be able to comment, but you wrote it. But any kind of insight you can offer would be fantastic. And keep in mind, we are close to the beginning of hurricane season. Hurricane season runs from June through November, basically 6 months. It's the wet season, if you will. This is where the storm comes rolling through. The peak of the season generally is August, September. So that's kind of that's the background, the context, if you will, for this story. So here we go with the headline again, South Florida Sun Sentinel. David, your piece, a game changer for South Florida, in quotes. High-tech builder opens factory to create bunker-like storm-resistant homes. And here we go with the first couple graphs. At some point in the not-too-distant future, hard-pressed Broward and Palm Beach County residents yearning for affordable storm-resistant homes may find a technologically advanced selection in a new community near them. More than three decades after Hurricane Andrew blasted its way across southern Miami-Dade County in 1992, a Texas-based home building firm called Onyx, which is O-N-X, in case you want to look it up online, O-N-X, Onyx, has set up a factory in Pompano Beach to produce key components of homes that it says can withstand Category 5 hurricanes and winds up to 175 miles an hour. The company, which started operations in 2021, is based in New Carrollton, Texas, near Dallas. Late last month, the firm opened its 150,000 square foot component manufacturing facility dubbed the X Plus System Factory, west of Interstate 95 in Pompano Beach. The factory employs 50 people, but relies mainly on robotics to produce roofing components and walls containing hurricane-resistant windows. It's an apropos time for the opening. Forecasters are expecting an extremely active 2024 hurricane season. David, sign me up.
Well, you have to sign up with them. They're the ones who control the process from A to Z. That means they have a website, and that's the only way you can pick your house. I guess they'll work with real estate agents, but they bought a tract of land down in Homestead, and they also constructed a couple of factories in Florida City, as well as this one up here in Pompano Beach. And they all manufacture different parts of the home, and the parts are put on a truck, taken to the site, and that's where the assembly is done. And they're people who are controlling the manufacturing process. It's their land. Although you're buying the land underneath the house when you buy it too, but you have to go through them mainly in order to acquire a home inside the community. And it's by way of background, it's a group of home builders from Dubai, and they saw an opportunity here in the South Florida market as well as in Texas. And the homes purportedly, there have been other stories written about this before mine, and the prices quoted are, for a two-level house is around $400,000 to $500,000. But, the walls are 8 inches thick. They have compressed concrete with other materials sandwiched in between. There are communities that are in progress. They've got different types of models. I'd have to say that it has this cookie cutter look about it. It looks like maybe a post-World War II Levittown type of a thing. The chief operating officer told me that they've done a fair amount of testing via modeling via AI, and but he did say that he wants to get to the point where they'll actually put a full house in a wind tunnel jack it up to 175 miles an hour and see what happens. But you know, they think they're on solid ground with the assertion that these homes can withstand winds of that strength. So will it take off? I don't know. I suppose it could, you know, given the market. You know, Homestead, $400,000 house. As mainly being a Broward resident over the years, I don't think of $500,000 homes being in a place like Homestead. But I guess that's where we are now.
David, quick question before I open it up to the floor. Did they talk about timing? How long does it take to actually build one of these or assemble one of these things? Since everything's created or manufactured elsewhere, then they bring it all together, they assemble it.
No, it's a matter of a couple of months or maybe less, maybe more, maybe a little less. But it's definitely a shorter time frame to build a house and using their methods than the standard contractor goes to the site and the parts arrive at. Arrive at the site for building by a bunch of guys who come from all directions, but it's a very methodical process, technology oriented, and it's I don't know, it could be the wave of the future. A lot of people have been talking about 3D printing, but that doesn't seem to have gained traction anywhere in Florida except for the people who have developed it up in the Tallahassee area. But it's possible that between the technology and the business model, it could take off. They want to be up this way. They're looking for land in Palm Beach County and Broward County. And they've got a development up outside of Orlando as well as in Southwest Florida.
Our next story, story number 6. We're going to go to John Fackler for this piece. Anybody who's watched the podcast this season knows that Mr. Fackler has been known to light up a cigarette along the way, so I figured he was the perfect person to go to for this story. Mr. Packer, I'm going to read you the headline in the first couple graphs, then I want you to comment. This is coming out of the Palm Beach Post. It's sort of a advice column. People send in letters or emails, and then the expert will comment on it. So that's the structure. And here we go with the headline. Owner furious at condos, no smoking at home policy is being ignored. Can a neighbor be stopped? That's the headline. I'm going to read you the submission to the expert, and then I'll read you some of the comments from the expert. Question. I live in a 55-plus condo association. In 2015, we passed a strict no-smoking bylaws, and I'm doing that in air quotes if you're listening on audio, not video. Smoking is not allowed on your property, including inside of your units. When I was president, I had to get our attorney involved to get one renter who smoked in a rental condo to stop, even though she rented with the no-smoking policy. This renter was deeded a unit nearer to my own by her deceased parents. What type of legal action can I take so she doesn't just ignore the bylaws? I also just found out that a board member smokes in her condo as well. And so I worry the new condo board is just going to ignore the bylaws. Unfortunately, I don't have the money to file a lawsuit. Signed, JD. And here is the response. And the response is going to come from a gentleman called Ryan Polyakov. And here we go with his response. They're JD. We're in a position that sadly many owners share. You have a right to bring legal action to enforce your own covenants and rules, but you don't have the financial means to do so. The Division of Condominiums has very limited jurisdiction over condominium disputes and does not have the power to investigate these types of rules violations. So you, as an owner, would need to bring your own legal action, which could cost tens of thousands of dollars, and if you lose, would subject you to being responsible for the defendant's legal fees. I've seen many owners declare bankruptcy after losing Mauritius lawsuits. I do not recommend that you bring an action on your own without an attorney. My experience is pro se litigants will almost always lose when facing off against the licensed attorney. The response goes on and on and on. Mr. Fackler, why don't you give us your take on it as somebody who smoked on our podcast? I don't know if you smoke at home, you don't smoke at home. What message do you have? Is this fair? And have you ever gotten any complaints about smoking in your place, if in fact you do?
Well, let me just back up first. I believe this gentleman was an attorney. He actually suggests inserting a board member as the only way around this, because the board member, somebody who's going to be pro following the rules, making sure that everything is followed to the T. Apparently, that's the only way to get anything done. In my situation, Peter, as you're well aware, I was not an owner, and I won't mention the city, but I was a renter. I didn't read the lease that closely. I'm not sure if I did it on purpose or just was an oversight. And I had a beautiful balcony. You know, all I had to do was go out to the balcony. And I was a putz, and I smoked in the apartment. And then when the lease was up and they did the walkthrough, apparently it was the son of the owner came through, and he was like, "What's going on in the place? You've been smoking in here?" I says, "Well, you know." He goes, "Well, you're not getting your security." He yelled my security, and he said that he's going to have to paint the entire place just to get rid of the smoke. So this thing went on, you know. There was some bad feelings, let's just say, between both parties. I'm sure I instigated it a little bit, but I learned a hard lesson. Never smoke in an apartment, no matter what your situation is, whether you're an owner of the unit and you have bylaws you got to follow, or if you're a renter, don't smoke in the apartment. Bottom line.
And Mr. Becker, do you happen to remember what your security deposit was that he lost?
It was the whole month. It was an entire month. So it was over. It was north of 1,000.
North of 1,000.
That was money I was going to depend on to help move. And I was like, wow, you know, this is hardcore here. So, you know, you live and you learn.
You know, a number of people smoking cigarettes, at least from what I see on the street, is going down. People are vaping or they're smoking weed if they're not vaping.
I don't think weed gets into the paint of the walls like cigarette smoke does. I think temporarily you can smell it, but I don't think it's as bad. I'm just guessing. Not that I know. But I'm just saying, I think, you know, the cigarette smoke is the worst. A cigar smoke, I'm sure, is worse.
I'm sorry, Jean.
Yeah, I mean, having lived in Brickell for 3 or 4 years, in some of those luxury high rises, I have to say that just about every floor has a weed smoker, has a marijuana smoker, and the smell is really overpowering. It's pervasive, and I knew some people who rented apartments there, whose neighbors smoked marijuana. And the smell just seeps from one unit to another. And, you know, and they could be smoking on their balcony, but it gets into the air conditioning. If you have your balcony door open, I mean, all the weeds, you know, that weed smoke goes wafting into your unit. I mean, it's everywhere. And now with the liberalization of marijuana rules, I mean, we have medical marijuana here in Florida. We're looking at a ballot now where marijuana may be legalized. And I think that's just gonna open the door to more problems in these buildings. I mean, it already is a huge problem. I mean, no amount of complaining does any good whatsoever. So, yeah. I mean, I know that from my personal experience.
So you actually were complaining to the condo board?
No, I wasn't complaining, but I had a neighbor who was complaining routinely, and it did absolutely no good, no good.
Yeah. Well, and Mr. Lyons, you're living vertical right now. You're in a
20-story
multi-level building. Right. Have you had any run-in with smokers, yes. Positive or negative, negative, whether it be someone like Mr. Fadler or some weed smoker?
Well, first of all, I'm a non-smoker. I've never smoked ever because I was an asthmatic when I was a kid. So you know, once I got to breathe, finally, I didn't think it was there was any upside to filling my lungs filled with smoke, regardless of.
I can see your point.
But anyway, my problem for a number of years, and this is a 20-story condo in Northeast Fort Lauderdale, and I have been living upstairs on the first on the 12th and then the 18th floor, so I really didn't have that much of a problem about what I'm going to describe. My landlady sold my 18th story apartment, so I had to move. Fortunately, I was able to get another place here in the building, but it's on the 6th floor. And shortly after I moved in, cigarette butts appeared on my balcony. People throwing them over the side from upper floors. So I don't know where they're coming from or where they have been coming from, but I've been filing complaints with the property management office. So But that's the main problem. Smoking, I don't believe, is allowed in this building. You know, what can you do legally? You know, the lawsuit game, you know, get in line, you know. I mean, those cases are never going to resolve themselves. Class actions, people are spending enough money, you know, trying to fix their buildings, let alone suing over the what's going on in the units and the common areas. So I really don't see the lawsuit route being very productive.
Mr. Fackler, quick question. When you smoked on the balcony in your building, what did you do with the butt?
Well, I certainly didn't flick him over the balcony, but I had
you did
a,
or did not?
No, I did not. I had a can, you know, I had a can of, which we call it, that I put all the butts in. Yeah.
I never gave the problem thought until I came down to this lower floor.
Listen, I'm having a nicotine fit just talking about this, right? Where's my cigarette?
Makes me want to smoke, too. Well, this is a fantastic podcast. We got some great context. We had some laughs. So I want to thank everybody who's on the podcast. I want to thank John Gruce. He's a journalist for over 25 years. Right now, he has his own publications marketing firm called Gruce Communications. Check out his website, grusspr.com, GRUSSPR.com. You can also get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at Sean Gruce, JEANGRUSS. I want to thank John Fackler. John was a journalist for over 20 years, wrote a publication, including the South Florida Business Journal. Right now, he does publications and marketing. You can get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at JT Fackler, JTFAKLER. And if you are somebody who's against smoking, if you see Mr. Fackler on the street, make sure to let him know that he should give it up. And I also want to thank David Lyons. David's a senior staff writer over at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. He's going to be celebrating his 50-year anniversary in journalism, which is just fantastic. Saludos to you, David. Congratulations. That is awesome. If anybody wants to get a hold of you, they can get you on X, which is formerly Twitter, at David Lyons, DavidLyons. And I'm Peter Zaluski of Pound of Vultures. If you have any comments for us, if you want to go off on Mr. Fackler's smoking in his apartment or not smoking or any of that type of stuff, get us at Miami RRP, at Miami RRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. It's not AARP, it's Miami RRP. And in terms of sponsorship, remember my company, condovultures.com, condovultures.com. You're looking for any information related to condos, you look for expert witness work, consulting, brokerage services, or if you want to sign up for our newsletter, just go to condovultures.com. Make sure to like the podcast, make sure to subscribe, and until next time, take care of yourself. We'll catch up soon. Ciao, ciao.
It's a simple formula, and it works. Buy low, sell high. We're Condo Vultures, and when it comes to your real estate, we help you buy low. At Condo Vultures, we represent the buyer, and now's the time to buy. Log on to condovultures.com for more information. Condovultures.com. And remember, before you sell high, you have to buy low. Featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, 60 Minutes, and Time Magazine. Condo Vultures Realty, a licensed Florida real estate brokerage capitalizing on the condo correction since 2006.
This is Peter Zaluski of the Condo Vultures Podcast. Before I started doing these podcasts, I've been in the business of being a licensed real estate broker, a contributing columnist for the Miami Herald, as well as the Miami Real Deal, but also extra witness work in consulting. So if you are looking for an expert witness, or if you're looking for consulting services, a straight talk perspective as to what's going on in a particular marketplace, a building, or what happened previously, for whatever your situation is, whether you are an attorney, whether you are an institutional fund looking to invest, or whether you're a lender who's trying to come up with some sort of a strategy and approach for your lending committee going forward, I don't just might be able to help you. To get a hold of me, please reach out to Peter at condovultures.com. That's Peter at condovultures.com. Or give me a call to the office at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859.